Johnny Cash's classic Folsom Prison Blues, talking about shooting a man in Reno just to watch him die. Well, that character in that song wasn't the only bad guy in Reno. As we've just learned from Bill Friedman, a lot of desperados were hiding out, laying low in Reno. In his new book, All Against the Law, he tells us why they were safe there. The kind of corruption that existed in Reno, later in Las Vegas, was present as well in Kansas City and may have reached all the way to the White House. We'll hear that part of the story in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Bill Friedman, you have a chapter in the book. It's called Hoover's War on Democracy, and I don't think that's an exaggeration. I mean, the kind of files that you were telling us about before the break that Hoover maintained on politicians of all stripes, it was a threat to democracy. You think about people like the Kennedys, who found themselves at odds with Hoover. They had to have been told, hey, we've got files on you, the kind of indiscretions that we now know about the brothers. What did they do in a spot like that? How do you get rid of the guy? I guess the answer is you don't.
I understand your question, but I can't give you a generalization because I just don't have enough information. But Bobby Kennedy was made Attorney General, and clearly he and Hoover had a war. In fact, a friend of the Kennedy family wrote a book about it. And Bobby Kennedy, for the first time, made Hoover do his job. He went after major gangsters. He went after Jimmy Hoffa, who had so much power as a union leader. And he forced the hand. And Hoover, his whole career, 48 years, think of all the presidents, attorney generals, he lied to America repeatedly and under oath in testimony to Congress. There is no such thing as the mafia in America. His way of eradicating crime was to deny it. And he repeated it over and over. And there was two times early in Hoover's career in which promises were made to people to assist the FBI, and he didn't hold up his end. And for that reason, again, America paid a price. For 25 years, no one in organized crime would turn state's witnesses. When the law is worse than the criminals, you stay away from it. Bobby Kennedy turned that around because there was a man by the name of Joe Valachi, who was a New York mafioso, and he wouldn't deal with Hoover like no one else would, but Bobby Kennedy made promises to him that he would be protected. Ultimately, that led to the secret witness protection program. And then Kennedy made Hoover accept it, but Hoover couldn't admit he'd been lying about the mafia, so his part of the deal was that Valachi and Kennedy would call it La Cosa Nostra, and therefore this was a new organization and they were going to go after it. So a lot of games were played, and the Kennedys, of course, did not fire him, but Bobby pushed him and finally got him going after organized crime. It didn't last after Kennedy was gone, but this is a very interesting thing I put in my book because of my orientation to the Nevada gaming industry. In the 15 years after Hoover's death, the FBI, under successive leaders, completely eradicated any organized crime from the casino industry, and it's very rare a law enforcement agency does that. Afterwards, they showed it could be done, but he wouldn't touch any of it.
Yeah, we were there to see the exorcism. It was, Bobby Kennedy had started it. They had him doing wiretaps and everything, but it took a long time to get those guys and squeeze them out of Las Vegas. I mean, they still make occasional forays, and they come in different guises and forms, but they're pretty much gone. You also mentioned about Hoover that he turned this agent, Melvin Purvis, into sort of this mythical crime buster guy, and it was all just kind of made up.
Well, they started at early in the, this is all in the very early FBI. Purvis was very close to Hoover. They liked each other, and everything was cool. But you got to remember that Hoover planned to be America's top crime buster. And now Purvis has an ego, and he's in the Chicago office, and he goes after Dillinger, and he's getting all of this newspaper press, and it's really upsetting Hoover, and he tells him to tone it down, but this man is on his own trip, and they get in conflicts about all the credit he keeps claiming. So now Hoover sends him to Cincinnati, which was a quiet office, to get him out of the way. And lo and behold, Pretty Boy Floyd ends up in the area. So Purvis, through sheer luck, they're searching for Floyd, have no idea where he is except he's been seen in the neck of the woods. And they run into a police car. And they said, have you heard anything? They said, yeah, we were at a home and got a phone call. Remember, there was no radio cars back then. And so they'd call in, and they said, we made a phone call, and we know where he is. Follow us. So they get in on the killing of Floyd, and he takes all the credit for it. So Hoover is beside himself, sends him back to Chicago, take someone from the home office in Washington, puts him over it, doesn't tell the public that, but makes it clear, you just, and they put, the secretary to Purvis a few years later wrote a series of articles in the Chicago Daily Tribune, and she described what happened, and they made him a desk jockey and just destroyed his self-respect. And the day they went out after Babyface Nelson, four different groups of pairs of FBI agents went out, and he wanted to join the head people, and they said, no, you stay here. Well, two of those FBI agents were shot to death, and Purvis goes to the hospital, and he comes out, and he says that the head man told him, get this guy, and he said, I promised on his deathbed that I would get Babyface Nelson, yet the doctor in charge testified that the man who Purvis claimed said that never regained consciousness, couldn't talk to anybody.
Oh,
so these two were just in a personality war of who was America's top cop. And afterwards, Purvis goes and creates an organization for children based on that. Post Toasties had a weekly cartoon ad covering half a page of Elvin Purvis's things. It was just a comedy of these two men trying to outdo each other in the press as America's top crime buster.
You mentioned in the last hour about this Kansas City massacre that sort of started the ball rolling with the creation of the FBI, and Kansas City figures in your book in several different ways, but it's central to the overall story, and part of that deals with political corruption there, this machine that was in operation in Kansas City that eventually has ties to the White House. Tell that part of the story.
Well, we have to go back again to what was in the era. Today we have primary elections. Back then, we had a Republican Party and a Democratic Party, an official party. In some major cities, there was a committee, but in the vast majority, it was one man, boss rule, and he had complete control because no one could run, like today, I'm going to run on a Republican or a Democratic candidate, that you couldn't do it. They had to appoint you. And they only had one candidate, and they supplied all the funds back then. Whole different system. So when the public voted in the general election, each party gave them a choice, and they took it. Well, these men had incredible power, and they were called political machines, and they were. And if you were on the inside, you benefited greatly. And if you were on the outside, you had trouble being heard. Well, the standard way these operated was all of them, I may be going too far, almost all of them were closely tied to organized crime in this era. Once prohibition came and these guys had all this money, they could, one, donate large amounts, but the second thing is they could intimidate the voters. And in many cities, when people went to vote, they were told by these thugs, you let me watch who you mark up or you can't vote. And in return for turning over the vote in their districts, they didn't go outside their territories. They were all in the lower income areas. That's where the street crimes, street gangs developed. They would turn over the election to whoever they chose, but in return, the typical thing was they were either allowed a wide-open, illegal casino or brothel in that district that the police wouldn't touch for the term of the person they put into office. And this went across the country. Kansas City was the most unique thing there was, and I had to get into it for this reason. With the Kansas City massacre, Hoover decided that Pretty Boy Floyd was one of the shooters. And the evidence was these two things. One, he was known to be in town the night before. He arrived in town the night before the crime. And second, a man that was believed to be a shooter who was local. A Pretty Boy Floyd's lieutenant was with him. His fingerprint was found on a beer glass in the guy's home. So you put a guy you think in Kansas City had something to do with it, and you put this fingerprint, and that was the assumption he made. The reason he was there when the lieutenant was captured, finally, he had a pistol that had been stolen from the Kansas City National Guard armory. And he was there buying a pistol because he couldn't carry a machine gun on the streets. And he wanted a gun to carry, which was his defense at the time when he was captured. So he took these two things and he assumed it was Floyd. Then a very interesting thing happens. There was a man by the name of Michael LaCapra, who was a very small-time mafioso for the Kansas City Mafia group. And he went under the name Jimmy Needles because he was an addict. He got on the outs with the gang. The investigative reporters of the era, and I would just like to say this, George, back then, the reason why I have so much data is the investigative reporters back then in so many of these major newspapers were so dogged the story and so were after the truth. Unlike the sensationalism we see in some of the news today, they just wanted the facts. And you represent that kind of thing. So I'm really enjoying being able to talk with you tonight. And investigative reporters said the word out there, and they knew all the hoods, was that he was pressuring them for a better part of the deal in his gang. They decided to get rid of him. They made one attempt on his life, and it failed. He's leaving town, and he's on the highway because he knows they're coming for him, and he's got two girls in the car, and they're driving along, and a car pulls up on their left with three men in it. The driver is controlling the vehicle, of course, and in the passenger seat and the man behind him, they open fire. And it becomes a high-speed chase, and fortunately for LaCapra, they speed off the road and get stalled. He saw a police station in the last town they were in. He races to it, runs in, says, I'll admit to any crime, lock me up. So they put him under a crime of suspicion for something, put him in a jail cell. Now the highway patrol finds the stuck car, And understand, the police know nothing. They haven't heard about a shooting. It happened out in the open, open from anywhere. And they don't know anything that's been going on, and so they try to help the people and find the guns and arrest them. They take these three guys and put them in the cell next to Jimmy Needles. Well, when they leave, these guys start explaining in detail how they're going to kill him. He takes a number of hours of this till he finally becomes hysterical, tells the police to get the FBI. He can solve the Kansas City massacre. So they take and put him in the only isolated cell they had, which was the death row, which must have been a horrible imagery for this guy. And he's waiting for the FBI to show up. They show up, and the story he gives them, he's a small guy, but his brother, who's already dead, told him the following facts, he claims. Now, that's always dangerous. You have to be very careful. In a court of law, it's tough because you can't interrogate the guy if you're on the defense. But if you're a legitimate prosecutor, you've got to be careful, because when you go after the details and facts, it says whether this guy's telling the truth. He says, well, that's what my brother told me. We know today he was lying. I've proven that without question. He gave several statements that can be absolutely proven to not be true. He was making it all up. He was telling Hoover what Hoover wanted to hear. And at that point, from then on till the records today, they still say that the Floyd people did it. To find out who did it, I went on an enormous research project into Kansas City, and I had to get into the political and mafia machines to show how the town really acted to get down to what happened. And what you've got now, getting back to the political machine, it was a 40-year phenomenon, and there was three members of the Pendergast family who were Irish. And back in when it was created, it was an Irish neighborhood. They were, I've got to step back a second. In each generation, we get different people immigrating to America. They tend, one, they have no money when they get here for the most part, and they tend to be from only certain ethnic groups, which changes with each generation. They were Irish at that point. They came into this area, and the first Pendergast took over, and then his brother took over from him. And they developed this democratic machine in this Irish area. They had enough votes that they became the most potent part of the Democratic Party. And they controlled the town. And they were very, very effective at what they did. They knew that these people wanted someone that represented their interests. And they did good things for individuals. If someone needed coal for the winter, if someone needed food, they'd deliver baskets. Every one of the Pendergast representatives that were out there had a pocket full of cash. And if someone said, I'm having problems, boom, came the cash. They helped in many ways, and they expected them to vote for them. But they took so much more than they gave. For example, the Pendergast owned something called the Ready Concrete Company. It got virtually every city and county construction job. And you're talking about a lot of money here. And he ran his political machine out of those offices. They also did a lot of illegal deals where if a businessman gave him a lot of support, his property taxes went down. If a guy opposed him, his property taxes went up. So they knew how to milk the people, but it doesn't mean they were nice or legal. But they controlled the party. Now, something happened in this situation that never happened in any other American city.
I'll tell you what, you have to hold that. It's a terrible place to break, but we have to. the music telling us we got to take a short break. When we come back, you can finish that thought, and I think it's going to lead to the White House. Peter Gabriel takes us into the break here on Coast to Coast AM. Great tune from War, Slipping into Darkness from 1971. We're talking with Bill Friedman, whose new book is All Against the Law. And I think I know where it's leading, but we're going to let him finish his thought about this Kansas City political machine that was synonymous with the mob and whether or not that leads to the White House. And then we'll try to take a couple of your calls right after this on Coast to Coast. Bill Friedman, sorry to interrupt you right at that key moment, but you were just about to tell us something that had never happened before. What was it?
And now we bring the mafia in, because when Pendergast had taken over, this was an Italian area, but it was late in its development, and these people were getting better jobs and moving out, and the new group coming in was Italian. And along with this came a mafioso by the name of Johnny Lazio. And he was the man during Prohibition. And he now had control of the voters directly. And he cut a deal with Pendergast that this would remain his territory. And he would deliver the vote. And he didn't have any political agenda. But he wanted one thing that no other organized crime figure ever got in this country. Instead of having the brothel or the casino or some other special thing like that, he demanded the right to select who would be the chief of police and who would be the detectives. Nothing like that's happened. It was as awful as you can imagine. It was so bad that the state of Missouri, the legislature, passed a special law applying only to Kansas City, that there would be a five-man police commission that would appoint all of the employees of the police department from the chief on down, and the five men would be appointed by the governor. Well, Lazio didn't let that slow him down. He just spread out his influence to more of the state. But in addition, he stuffed, and this was proven, hundreds of people went to jail for it, not for making an extra vote. They went to long-term prison sentences. They stuffed in each election tens of thousands of false ballots in Kansas City so that they had enough votes to overwhelm the St. Louis, the second biggest city, and the rural areas. And this was a nightmare. During Prohibition, it was said in the national press that it was the only town in America where no one ever knew there was Prohibition, because there was no limits whatsoever. Well, in the media, both locally and nationally, the mafia chieftain was never called a gangster, a mafioso. He was the political lieutenant of the Pendergast machine. If you were a Democrat, you called him a political leader, the newspaper, and if it was a Republican newspaper, they called him a political boss. That was the nastiest thing they could say. Well, in studying this situation, I did solve the massacre, but what became very interesting in reading paper after paper all those years is Harry Truman was developed by this machine. He had been a leader of a unit, an artillery unit, in the First World War in France. And one of the men under his command was the son of Pendergast. Well, Truman came back, and he went broke as a haberdasher. And there was a family farm that struggled, and of course, this actually helped him with the people, because this was the Depression, and businesses and farms were having trouble. He was a man of the people and understood them. Well, he was elected by the Pendergast machine, because of this relationship, to become what was called a county judge. It was Jackson County, and it was called a judge in most of the country, we call this a county commissioner. It had nothing to do with the law. He spent a number of years there, was very loyal to them. There's no evidence whatsoever that he ever pocketed anything, but he was loyal to bad people. And he did this for a number of years, and then he saw a position open in which he could make more money than he was making, and he went to Pendergast, and he said, I'd like to get to run for this position because it would help my family. And Pendergast looked at him, and he said, well, I'm sorry, but the only thing I have open for you is a U.S. senatorship. Do you want it or don't you? So he went from county commissioner to U.S. senator, and he was in his second term as U.S. senator when he became the fourth and final vice president to on the ballot for
FDR,
Franklin Roosevelt. Now, Roosevelt was getting weaker and weaker from polio, and Truman did all the campaigning and won that election. And 3 months later, Truman became president. Now, Truman always remained loyal to this group. But this was the incredible part. Not only has no other president been involved with organized crime or sold out, but the whole last chapter of my book is the interactions between this mafioso and the president, because the president had the same problem of deadlock that we have today. It was a Republican Congress, and they didn't like his domestic policies, and they were blocking everything. And there was a Democratic representative in Kansas City, in Kansas City, who voted with the Republican bloc because he disagreed too. And the president wanted him replaced with a loyal Democrat. He dealt with the mafia chieftain, and he said, you stuff the ballot boxes and put in somebody else. And they were dealing as a partnership for a while. But this one, remember, this has been going on for decades. This mafia chieftain was now Charles Bonaggio, and he thought, why should I answer to someone that doesn't even live in this part of the community? And he very quietly, over a few years, developed his own political machine with the people and challenged the Pendergast. And he also then ran his own slate of Democrats into the primary, so we no longer just had one vote. Well, the president was furious, and he ordered a IRS investigation, which, of course, there should have been one, but he had his own motives, and these two go to war with each other. And this is the war between them, and all this political jockeying going on from the White House to this mafioso, until one day the mafioso is shot to death in his Democratic Party headquarters on Truman Road, and a picture's flashed across America of this man sprawled out under a huge portrait of the president. Well, the Republicans, the next day in both the Senate and the House, I mean, this was wide open, everybody knew about this, they literally accused the President of the United States of having ordered his political henchmen to kill him. Now, that wasn't true, of course, but it was incredible politics. In the meantime, Estes Kefauver was a new senator who wanted to do a crime investigation, and nobody in Congress wanted it, but nobody wanted to be anti-law enforcement, so they kept his proposal bottled up, because across the country, in certain cities, the Democratic machine was tied up to the organized crime. In other cities, the Republicans were. For example, Al Capone That was totally a Republican machine. Both of them were guilty. None of them won investigation. Once this happened, nobody could stop it, and we end up with Congress investigating the local crime. They didn't learn anything in Kansas City, but it was the greatest crime investigation ever that came out of this. And this is the story of this back and forth between them. And the most incredible part of the story is the president learned about a great, what he thought was a great business opportunity. It was going to be a small, privately held business. And the mafioso, he wanted to get out of this pending IRS criminal charge, and he was trying to placate the president finally, and he secretly was investing in the president's company. And I mean, all of this is documented. There's paperwork for everything. It is absolutely incredible what went on between them.
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, the story arc, I mean, the tentacles that it has, it's just an amazing tale how high it led. I want to take a call from one of our listeners east of the Rockies, Michael in Virginia Beach. Hi, Michael. You're on with Bill Friedman.
Thank you. You've done it tonight better than anybody does it. I hope we'll hear part two next week and that all my fellow Coast to Coast listeners will email George to tell him we want Bill Friedman and George Knapp back next week to give us part two. This is the destiny of our country that's at stake, and this man is giving us the key on how to get it back. We go back to Hoover and the war between him and Bobby Kennedy, and we ask ourselves, is this going on now? We have the five leading candidates for the Republican presidential nomination as governors under some form of investigation or indictment right now. Is the Obama Justice Department and FBI being used in a mafia-like fashion to disenfranchise the Republican voters of this country? I ask you that, Bill Friedman.
I'm a historian, and I have to wait until this information comes out. So I can't comment on what's going on today, but your point, which I think is so critical, the thing that all this information says, Congress, when they create a secret organization, they have to give it very clear guidelines under the law, clear restrictions under the law, and then vigilantly account for everything they do. And if they don't, yes, the government can use them, but they can go off on their own. And both of them are frightening, and I think there should be enormous focus on that.
Thank you, Michael. Appreciate it. Did you want to continue that?
Our friends.
Go ahead, Michael. Yes.
We here in Virginia Beach are friends of former Governor Bob McDonnell, and it looks to us here who have known this man for all of his political life, it looks to us here like somebody got paid a $10 million bribe to go to be the number one witness against the McDonald's. It looks like a frame-up. There doesn't seem to be any crime here as we see it.
I think you raise interesting questions, but I think it's beyond the scope of what Bill was prepared to talk about tonight. But thank you for the call. I appreciate it. I guess maybe what Michael was sort of leading toward was whether or not anything similar goes on today. The as far as your book goes, Bill, you sort of lead up to the exorcism of the mob from Las Vegas, and there's certainly nothing like what it was in the 70s and 80s, but it took a heck of a long time to get those guys out of there, the mafia, La Cosa Nostra, whatever you call it. As you note, a lot of the old-time guys, the bootlegger interests, sold out to different mobsters who, they persisted. I mean, they hung on for a long time. It was hard to get them out of there.
Yeah, it you know, Hoover didn't try, and after him it was extremely difficult. The state couldn't do anything because there's always been a state law that even law enforcement cannot wiretap, and the FBI finally did it through wiretaps and state witnesses, and again, in many of these cases, luck plays a role. One man, they went in and in one of the main cases in that they made, they raided one man's home, and he'd kept accounting records of everything.
Right. Kansas City guy, right?
It's just tough. I mean, in organized crime, if they keep their mouths shut and don't keep paperwork, it's very hard to link them into it. That's why I complimented the FBI to be able to finally ultimately do it. But it was a tremendous difficult task.
You know, you mentioned about Nick Civella and the influence they had with the Teamsters Fund, which gave money to so many casinos in Las Vegas. And the, you know, the reason that the town was crying out for it is because casinos couldn't borrow money from banks. That was their bank.
Yeah, it was a tainted industry, and until the corporations finally took over and proved they could run it, the legitimate financing institutions, one, were afraid of the imagery of organized crime, but the other thing was they were uncomfortable with people who wanted to be in Nevada but hadn't proven they could operate a casino. And yeah, interestingly, the history of Nevada is up until the 80s. One of the key things is the source of revenue. We're talking about what went on then, but even in earlier eras, it was a constant struggle to find people who would loan, and the irony is they paid the highest rates. In other words, if you were in the casino business because of the supposed risk, you paid a higher rate, and except for a few places that were poorly run, they all paid. It was a tremendous investment.
Well, the mob had to go for Las Vegas to bloom and blossom into what it is today, and it's fabulous on many levels. But there are, as you know, longtime Las Vegans and Nevadans who yearn for a day, not necessarily when the mob ran casinos, but when the town was smaller, when there were places like the ones that you ran, the Silver Slipper, the Castaways, that were friendly to locals, that were good bargains. I mean, it's a different Las Vegas. It's great on many levels, but it sure is different. Don't you agree?
Oh, yes. Back in the era where I learned and I operated, this Las Vegas was purely a gambling town. It was a resort. Every department except for the rooms and the casino lost money. It was to drive the casino. The casino had the greatest share of revenue, the greatest share of profits. And with the mega resort, it became a convention town. And today, the casino is a minor player in that.
It's not as much fun, at least in the view of a lot of folks. Bill Friedman, this is a masterpiece of scholarship on your part. I hope people will check out the book, All Against the Law. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'll talk to you soon. And thanks also to my earlier guests, Doug Swanson and Stapleton Gray, and to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Tricia Pepe, Nathan Staten, Dan Galante, and Chris Boros. And I'll be back next Sunday with a UFO Palooza. Hope you can tune in then. Good night, everyone.